Hello everybody, James here, Storytime with Dutch Mantel, episode 61.5. This is Ask Dutch Anything. So if you want to ask Dutch anything, you send your question into questionsfordutch@gmail.com. And for God's sake, a lot of you have done that. So many, in fact, there's no way we're going to be able to get to all the questions you've sent in if we had 2 months, for Christ's sake. So we are going to do our best. We have got some of the best questions we found out that we read in the email. There are plugs. We've got books. We've got T-shirts. All right, let's get into it. First question. Jeremy, Fall River, Massachusetts. I recently discovered that Eddie Kingston was used mostly as a manager rather than wrestling in Impact Wrestling back in 2016-2017. This is when you were working there. Was this your idea to keep him out of the ring and cut promos? Also, what do you think of Kingston as a talent for AEW/ROH as far as believability, wrestling and promos are concerned? Thanks. So, Eddie Kingston in Impact first.
Eddie Kingston in Impact?
Yep.
I got there and they weren't using him. Because I'm not trying to say they used him any better when I got there. Because people know about my Impact run. I spent most of it in catering, which is what I preferred. But Eddie Kingston, I heard him do this interview, and I went, why in the hell aren't we using this kid better? This guy could go. He could talk. And he could talk in a way that made you damn believe him. Because he didn't talk at you. He talked to you. So that is why I mentioned it to some people. Of course, I may as well have been talking to the walls. I mentioned it to somebody. Hell, he may have been a damn janitor. I don't know. But I mentioned it because I know I mentioned it. But this guy is such a good talker. I mean, we're wasting this guy. We're wasting him in the ring, actually. Now, he could get in the ring. But Eddie could go in the ring, too, but he had a different style. But if we started him talking and then brought him into something, and Impact, we were so flooded with TV at the time, I never really could convey the message. Let's tell some stories, which takes time. It takes effort. It takes leaving the studio, taking a camera crew with you, or at least one cameraman, and going and doing these other things. And I had some ideas for him, but we never got around to doing that. Eddie Kingston, I like the guy. I really do. You could tell he's streetwise guy because he talks like, and he'll tell you he's from the streets. And I appreciate that. To get to where he got, or where he is today, it took persistence. It took a lot of little bullshit independent shows, but that's what you do. You know, if you want to get in the business, you got to go do these bullshit independent shows, but never downgrade them. Always look at them as a step up. Try to keep on those steps taking you up. Now you may do another independent show that is not as good as the last one, but that's the nature of the business. Musicians have the same thing. They keep playing at these dives and keep playing at these dives till somebody notices them, or they send a tape in somewhere, or they get some attention on them. And then all of a sudden somebody finds them and they take off. But my suggestion for Eddie Kingston and Impact, but he'd already been there a while, I had too. So I suggested taking him out of the ring so much and just make him a manager, then let him re-enter the ring after he's gotten over talking.
I think that basically he was going to give up on wrestling altogether right around the time AEW was formed. So it's almost like a bit of a Cinderella story in the fact that he was about to retire, just leave the business. AEW comes along, gives him one last shot, and then he does quite well there. So Eddie Kingston, as far as I don't know, believability, wrestling, basically his AEW run, good.
No, it's great. People like him. He gets in the ring and he's hitting this Japanese guy with his back spinning fists, and the guy didn't go down, and he looked at the crowd like, what the hell I got to do? And they responded to that. They like him. He has what I call, they accept him, acceptability. And they feel as though they know him. Because he's street. he's not in there talking, you know, and some other type voice, which can be entertaining as well. But Eddie Kingston outside the ring is the Eddie Kingston you see inside the ring. And I think that's part of his, the fans, they think they know him. He's like their next door neighbor, but a tough neighbor. And they think they know him. And that's why he's had so much success.
Next question, Josh Stouffville, Somerville, GA. I know this is a better question for Jerry Lawler. I sent this question to his old podcast host several years ago, but it never got brought up, probably because the old podcast host absconded when they found out he was a scam artist. Get better soon, Jerry. I wanted to see if Dutch
Wait a minute. I got to hear this now. What happened?
Oh, my God. It was a big old story where Jerry ended up getting sued. I think this podcast, I think it's called Gary something. He was promising, like, signed or, like, personally drawn pictures to fans from Jerry Lawler taking the money and then not telling Jerry about it. And then essentially got found out, and he's just completely disappeared. Ever since, he's disappeared. He's off the grid. That was a few years ago.
So he took in a lot of money for something he didn't deliver.
Yes, and didn't tell Jerry
about
it either. Yeah.
That's fraud.
Yeah. So anyway, he's disappeared.
I can imagine if he told Lawler that would have never happened, because Lawler said, no, I'm not doing that. And I don't think his what was he charging for a picture?
Oh, he's charging probably like four figures. He's probably like $1,500 or something. So he was coining
what?
In. Yeah.
Damn, that's major fraud.
Yeah. Hey, if anyone wants me to do a picture
fans,
for them,
listen, so. Yeah, if fans want any picture of them drawn from me individually, it's nowhere like $1,500. It's $100 and I'll sign it at the bottom.
Yeah.
And, it may not look like you, but believe me, it's legitimate, it's authentic, and it's from me with love, Dutch.
Is this a good time to mention that I've been taking orders for you to draw pictures for the fans that have been charging $1,500 a picture? And actually, I'm going now. Goodbye.
that would be a good time. And I say, I would be calling your girlfriend, who I've never met, by the way, and say, where did James go? And she said, that's a good question. Where did he go? And they'd probably find you on some Mediterranean island somewhere. You've been doing this for a year, so you probably taken in about $400,000 to $500,000 and absconded. I like that word, absconded. Okay,
name.
But so that is a good word.
So
the, okay, read the question. I don't think a lot of people knew that out there.
Oh well, about this, it was called like Dinner with the King, Dinner with the King or something like that. Anyway, I wanted to see if Dutch has any memories that he'd be willing to share about Lawler's pre-Jimmy Hart manager, Sam Bass, who died in a car accident in 1976. I'm not even sure. Would you have ever even met Sam Bass at that point?
No, I met him. I knew him. I had worked there before. Not for long, but I did.
Basically, any memories of Sam Bass? Sadly, I think he's been a largely forgotten figure. Thanks and keep up the great work.
Yeah, he is a largely unforgotten figure. He just worked in Memphis. He was a wrestler, but, you know, I talked about Eddie Kingston being street. Sam was the same thing, except he was country street. And he would get those people worked up, because everybody in the arena thought they could kick his ass. And he was drunk about half the time, even when he's with Lawler. But Lawler got so much heat, and Sam already had some. So together they were a hot duo, as long as they had strong baby faces. And he did at the time. He had Jackie Fargo, and he had Bill Dundee, and he had those ones they would bring in from every now and then to challenge Lawler. But Sam, I don't know where he was from. He was from somewhere, I'm sure, around Memphis, either in Tennessee or Arkansas, I would think. Never knew exactly where he was from. But he was the same way outside the ring as he was when he did an interview. It's the same time. He didn't change anything. He just took Sam Bass off the streets and put him Sam Bass on camera. He sounded the same. I think he was, I don't know a lot about him, but I do remember him getting killed on that bridge coming back from Memphis, because Sam drove like a bat out of hell. And Lawler drove like a bat out of hell. And I read one night that Sam asked him I think that night, did Jerry want to ride with him? And Lawler said, no, I got to go do something else. They both lived in Nashville at the time. So, and had Lawler been with Sam, I can't say the same thing would have happened. But if Lawler had been in that accident, he'd have gotten killed too. So what happened when they was coming down I-40? Here's Memphis, and here's Nashville. And I know exactly where it happened. I think it happened at mile marker 164, I think. Because I crossed that bridge every time we went to Memphis coming back. It was on the way back to Nashville. And what had happened, I think some car was stalled on the bridge. And I think by the time Sam drove so fast, he didn't, and he had no lights on the car because it was stalled. And by the time he got there, they just crashed right into it. I think it was stalled leading onto the bridge and then killed all three of them instantly. Pepe Lopez, and I can't remember the other guy that got killed. And it was a bad, bad wreck. And a lot of the other, since they drove 100 miles an hour, there was a lot of wrestlers still leaving Memphis. They left later than they did. And so that they would probably come along about 30 minutes later or maybe more. And the traffic was backed up. Even though the traffic at that time of night, it'd be about 1 o'clock in the morning, 12:30 anyway. I don't know how much traffic would be backed up, but they probably, it was a big scene. And some of the wrestlers passed and they said, that looks like Sam's car. So they went down, and I remember Jerry Jarrett told me this. He went and parked his car, him and Tojo. He rode a lot with Tojo. And they went back and they said, that's Sam's car. And they saw no ambulances around. So they had to figure, just police cars. They had to figure that those guys were dead. I think they asked some of the officers there, the state patrol officers, what do you got? And then they said they worked with this guy. And I think they told him they were dead, which they're not supposed to do, by the way. I mean, that was, I guess you could, 1976, you could tell people without telling next to kin. I don't think they give much thought to that, but they were dead instantly. And Lawler, like I said, he drove a bat out of hell too. And he got there pretty quick. I think he was the first one on the scene of the guys. Because you had guys leaving earlier in the night that were on earlier. But these guys were there to the end, so they'd all leave about the same time. But as far as personal knowledge about Sam, I didn't have a lot. I do know that they drove fast because they used to pass me on the road sometimes. And they go, whoosh. And I was doing 70, or whoever I was with was driving. They'd be the driver of the car, not me, because I didn't drive that much. I tried not to. And they thought it was funny. And it's funny until one day it's not. So that was the day it wasn't funny.
The third person was Frank Hester.
Frankie Hester.
Yeah. I-4. And near Dixon, Tennessee, apparently.
Yeah, it was.
We will
Dixon,
move
Tennessee. We'll and move that was about, that's about 40 miles or 50 miles from Nashville.
We shall move on. And next question is Chris Bloomer, Binghamton, New York. Greetings, gents. In watching some mid-80s NWA WCW episodes lately, and what I noticed, wanted to ask, Ronnie Garvin looks like he's pretzeling enhancement talent. How stiff was he with the preliminary guys?
Oh, Ronnie?
Yeah.
He was stiff, but a lot of guys liked to work that way back in the day. Garvin was, he didn't stiff the enhancement talent much more than he stiffed the regular guys because they knew he was stiff. So if you know somebody's kind of stiff, you know, you can deal with it. But Wrestling and being stiff is different than throwing punches and being stiff. A lot different. If you throw an errant, you like that word, errant? You throw an errant punch, you could kind of ring a guy's bell. That's what gets their attention. So I've given some receipts for it. You know, a guy hit me hard, then I wind back and I'd say, here's your receipt, bam, and I'd get back. Then we're different. Then we're equal. And he knows what it's for. He knows he hit me hard, but he didn't mean to. But Ronnie Garvin, and he'd tell you in the dressing room, hey, you know, I'm a little stiff, you know. That's the way Ronnie does. Hey, you know, I'm a little stiff, you know. And I only had a couple matches with him, but he wasn't much stiffer than a lot of other guys. He just might have made it look better. I don't know. But with the enhancement talent, he was leading them and taking them. He was actually doing them a favor because they couldn't screw up then. If he had them, go here, go there, lay down, shut up, don't do this. Take your finger out of my anal cavity, please. That's not funny. You laughed. I can't believe you laughed at that.
I can't believe they put that on TBS.
But yeah, Ronnie was pretty stiff, but no secret. Everybody knew it, and he'd tell you that.
This fellow's also named a couple of people as examples, but I don't want to tell them to sway your opinion. But who were some of the guys that were super stiff in the ring, especially towards the job guys?
Well, I can't really remember right now. But even if a guy was stiff with the job guys, when he'd come back out, somebody guy said, man, lighten up on those guys. So they're not making any money. And you're going out there now, they won't come back. So now we got to look for some more job guys. Don't beat them up. And even when I was a booker, I had a guy, he would treat him roughly. I said, stop it. Don't do that, because these guys, like I said, they're not making any money. They're doing it because they love wrestling. So don't go out there and beat the crap out of them. Don't do that. And if he continued to do it, I'd take him off TV. I don't care who he was. Because most of the guys doing the stiffing of these guys weren't the top-notch guys. They weren't. Hang on a minute.
You've got a coffee coming in.
No. Yeah, it was usually the guys who were really trying to get over that they've just come in, but they would just go out here and they would just beat these guys up. But not many of them, because the other guy, if they did that, like I'd say, we'd get them in the dressing rooms and stop. The only two you could really beat up that liked to be beat up was the Mokey brothers. The more you did it to them, the more they liked it. And I told them one day, and they're from, we talked last week about Tommy Siegler from South Carolina. The Mokey brothers was out of the same group.
And they, Anderson, South Carolina, I think they were from.
That's where they were from. And they'd get in there, and they were, to me, they were heat-seeking guys. And they'd stand over there like this. You announce them. They have no body. They have the white skin, that blonde hair.
They were almost like translucent, weren't they? They were almost like glass.
And they were so hilarious. I just standing in the corner, and guys would just beat the shit out of them. I saw the Rock and Roll, not Rock and Roll, the Midnight Express. They give them some kind of a big suplex on the concrete. And this was at TBS in Atlanta at the Studio Wrestling. Oh, I felt bad for him. Because you could hear his bat hit splat. Oh, my God. But they liked that. And really, that's where I got my idea about the loser, the guys who can't win a match. And I took it, and I first made do with it with Barry Horowitz in Florida, Jack Hart. He could not win a match, and you couldn't get it over any faster. It took about 3 weeks. Then I put his one loss record up where he lost another match. And he was like 0 wins and 64 consecutive losses. Oh my, and every week that number would go up and it'd go up a little more and go up a little more. Well, that's where I got my idea about the loser gimmick. These guys got over by getting beat. I said, well, what if you made an angle out of this? The guy that can't win a match. So I first debuted it in Florida with Jack Hart. People in Florida, they know what I'm talking about. And then his name is Barry Horowitz. Now he went to WWF back in those days. And I took him out there, and he was a high school wrestling star or something, and he couldn't win a match. And he come out on TV one day with Gordon Solie and says, you know, I've been in a slump lately, but that slump ends today because I'm so-and-so, I'm Barry Horowitz, and I'm Jack Hart, and I won this, and I won that. And he went to the ring. Guess what? He got beat. Oh, my God. Gordon, he just – you know how Gordon had that – like you could tell when Gordon was kind of – entertained by something, he said, well, Mr. Hart, what do you got to say now? But of course, as he was going back to the dressing room next week, he come out there, said the same thing, went in the ring, got beat. And then I think I did it 3 weeks, but the end of the 3 weeks, I showed his record there. It was like 0 wins and 64 losses. And he was over and he had heat. I said, what if I really do something with this guy? But that time before I ever really got a chance to do anything with him, Eddie Graham had killed himself. I got disillusioned on booking Florida because, you know, I had almost every day interaction with Eddie, not every day, but a lot. And all of a sudden he killed himself and I just lost my interest in even being there. So I give my notice and left. And that's the end of that story. But the Mulkey brothers, they like getting beat up as far as other guys liking to beat guys up. I mean, if I went in the ring with the Mulkeys, they said, lay it in. I said, brother, I'm not going to lay it in. Just sell it. That's all you got to do. I'm going to make a move towards you and just take a bump like I've killed you.
Next question. I'm not sure you'll have an answer for this, but I'll ask it anyway. Hello, guys. Love the show. Listening from Oregon. Hey, Dutch, James. I was curious on your thoughts about Art Barr.
He was Beetlejuice.
He was.
Art Barr was good as Beetlejuice. Because I had some matches with him in Atlanta, WCW. Very easy. And now Art was nothing like his brother Jesse. I had Jesse in Florida. And Jesse was pretty tough and a good guy.
Was he Jimmy Jack Funk at one point?
Jimmy Jack Funk. Yeah. He was. He was that. But he kind of broke in, I guess, in Oregon. Then he came to Florida, and I was booking down there. But what he didn't have experience. And he was doing stuff in the ring, and I would call him to the side. I said, okay, do this and do this. And then I had a lot of matches with him where I was kind of, you know, usually the heel leads. But in this case, if I didn't lead, the match wouldn't get done. I went in a few spot shows with him, and I'm following protocol by letting the heel call stuff, but he wasn't calling nothing. It may have been because he didn't know what to call or was afraid to call because I was the booker. And finally I says, you want me to call it? He went, yeah, yeah, go to, if you want to. Yeah, I'm going to have to. Then I started calling it. Then the match got a lot better because now we were doing stuff that kind of, you know, would follow the regular workings of a good match. So he learned just by listening to me, and he learned by my term I use, osmosis, just by being there. So he turned into a great worker later on. But I think he got most of that experience in Florida, working that every night style, because we worked 7 nights a week in Florida. We worked every Sunday in Orlando. So yeah, Art was a lot different than Jesse, because Jesse was a lot bigger, but Art was a good worker.
Next question from Mike Sanders. I'm wondering if it's WCW's Mike Sanders who's wrote this in. Hi, Dutch. Hulk Hogan has regularly talked about his heel runs and seems to think he was as good as a heel as a babyface. I'm not even going to give you my opinion on that. What do you think, Dutch? Kind regards and God bless.
Now, he was better as babyface. But the people hated him as a heel, too. Because he's a very hateful type guy. You could hate him real easy. Because, hey, brother, hey, brother. I mean, how many hey brothers can you take before you say, shut the fuck up? Hey, brother. Yeah. What are you going to do when these 24-inch pythons run wild on you, brother? Oh, my God. But he was better as a babyface. but he drew money in both directions. He did. But he drew money as a heel in WCW. Now, I don't know if he would have drawn as much money in WWE because I don't think Vince had the guts to destroy his own invention, because Vince did kind of invent Hulk with some help from Nature Boy Buddy Rogers and a lot of those other blonde guys that have come along. And but he got his attention as a heel in WCW with Hall and Nash, and they had a lot of heat, a lot of
next.
Did that answer that question
very, very succinctly as well? It did. Next question, Phil Callahan. Hey, Dutch and James, as a kid growing up in Memphis, I wanted to get your take on the night Austin Idol and Tommy Rich shaved Jerry Lawler's head. I was in the third row that night and remember the fans pushing towards the cage. Paul Heyman retreated to inside the cage for refuge, and they all hauled ass through the crowd running for safety. Thank you so much for my childhood memories. Were you in Memphis at the time?
No, but I heard about it. Well, I don't know what else they could have. They wanted that response. Because they wanted to anger that crowd. Excuse me. They wanted to anger that crowd, and they did. I mean, all of a sudden, now here's Jerry Lawler. He's like the hometown sweetheart of Memphis. All of a sudden, it was Austin Idol and Tommy Rich.
Mm-hmm.
Two blonde-headed guys. And Austin Idol was a good heel, and Tommy Rich was too. So they shaved his head, and that's the response you wanted, and they got it, and they drew a lot of money off that.
Were you there for any of the later head shavings? Because didn't like Bill Dundee get his head shaved, and then his wife got his head shaved, and loads of people got their head shaved?
I wasn't there. I heard about that, but that was part of their drawing power too, because I think when Dundee's wife, when she got her head shaven, nobody would expect that at all. Say, instead of a guy getting his head shaven, the wife believed in her husband so much that she'd put her own hair up if he would just take the match. Boy, Lawler had a field day with that. He said, hell, you're ugly now. Just imagine how ugly you'd be with no hair. he tore her up. And he said, we'll see how much love is left after you show up bald-headed in the bed. Oh, my God. And Bill lost. They shaved her head.
Have you ever been in a head shaving? Or even
yes,
a mustache shaving would have been
I didn't have a mustache then, but I have been in a head shaving.
Really?
Yes. And I was so green. I was doing this angle with Ted Oates in Georgia, all over the states, all over the state, you know, territories back then, they didn't run over the state lines much. That was one of the, it wasn't written down, but it was, you know, popularly believed that you didn't cross the state line into another territory. Damn. Excuse me, folks. I'm just coming off a near-death experience with a summer cold. But, and I lost the match in Columbus, Georgia. It didn't quite sell out, but I never remember a sellout in Columbus, Georgia anyway. But it almost sold out. We were like, this was the first time they put us in a main event. and it almost sold out. And we were always like second match on the card every night. At the highest we went was third. But we burned those people out so much. I mean, you know, we were talking about kayfabe like last Friday when we did our other podcast. And I said kayfabe was dead. Kayfabe wasn't dead then. Kayfabe was alive and kicking because those people actually thought, of course, they all thought, yeah, there's a little fakiness involved here. Because kids who grew up with say your prayers, take your vitamins, and wrestling's fake. That's what they grew up with. But when me and Ted Oates got in the ring, they actually believed that we were mad at each other, that we were trying to hurt each other. And after some of those matches, I had to agree with them. We were trying to hurt each other because I was hurting every match. But I was young, and it didn't bother me. But we had this match for the loser cuts their hair. And I had longer hair than Ted, so when mine were cut, I got a picture of it. I'll send it to you.
Oh, definitely.
I would be sitting there, and all of a sudden, no hair. And some young girls in the crowd, they started crying. Because I guess some young girls in the crowd would start crying if Ted got his head shaven, too. Because your allegiances, you know, you wanted your favorite to win, and you're not so favorite to lose his hair. Well, I lost and got my head shaven.
Next one. Two people wrote in this past week with the exact same question. So, William Harrison.
Conspiracy.
Well, maybe it's the same person with two different emails, but William Harrison and Rick and I were both asked this this week. I can't remember which version I'm asking, but one more question. What is Dutch's take on a great worker and shitty human, Bob Sweetan? And then the other one was, do you have any observations or stories about Bob Sweetan? Work promoters blind to what he was doing?
Bob Sweetan was only in the business about, when I got in the business, I think he left. Because I guess when he saw the old cowboy coming in, time to get out. Okay, what was he accused of doing? I used to hear this. What was
accused of doing? I'll find out and I will read it to you verbatim. Okay, this is from Wrestling Observer. In 1990, police found him and arrested him for sexually abusing his daughter when she was 15, as well as non-payment of child support. He pleaded guilty to the sexual abuse in 2000 when he stopped checking with police. They found him and deported him to Canada, where he lived the past 16 years before dying in 2017.
Okay. Well, the Bob Sweetan thing, I kind of knew about it, but kind of didn't when I was around him. He wasn't in the business long after I got in, or he was in a separate territory. But from what I gathered, he abused his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is what you heard at the time. Yeah.
I didn't hear this at the time. I thought it was abusing young girls.
Okay.
It's what I heard. And I never had a lot of interaction with him because he only really worked about. I met him in Kansas City, I think. And he was a kind of a different guy, kind of a different individual. He wasn't anything around me. He wasn't anything for small talk or how you doing or whatever. Yeah, I'd sit down in the dressing room and he'd look at me and I'd look at him. That's as far as it'd go. Never had any matches with him, nor did I want to have any matches with him. But, and that's about my knowledge of.
I believe Jim Ross once called him a miserable human being, so he was never a fan.
He would, one day if he was around him, he was wanting to kill himself. And the next day, he's wanting to kill you. Then the next day, you just wanted to kill yourself being around him all the time. It was crazy. But anyway, listen, I want to bring this up, and I've never brought this up before.
Okay.
I am a huge fan of watching documentaries about serial killers. And I'm thinking, wow, what could have been a better serial killer than a wrestler?
You have advanced this theory before, and I'm sure you told somebody who was under a mask sorry, some fans asked you about a wrestler in a mask, like Jody Hamilton or something, and you said, oh, yeah, he wears a mask because he killed people over in another state.
I may have said that. I don't know, but I did. I did say that. I came out of this match, and it was when the assassins were there.
Yeah.
And one of them says, who are those guys, Dutch? And I said, I look around like this, like if he, I say, I'm not supposed to tell you this, and don't tell anybody. Oh, I won't. I won't. I won't tell a soul. I said, he had to come here because he killed two or three people out in California. What? Oh, yeah. Don't tell anybody. Oh, I won't. I won't. He says, that's why he put the mask on so they won't know where he is. Okay. Now, you know, the first person they ran across, that was the first person they're going to tell. And they loved that. So they never looked at the assassin again without thinking about he's killed a bunch of people. And probably two or three people went to about 10. Then it went to 12 or maybe more, but they're looking for him. But that would have been a good story, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I
because you're
I
in
the... It has happened. It has happened, in fact. In Mexico, there was a woman...
Oh, that's in
killer.
Mexico.
Well, anything goes then. But no.
There was a wrestler?
Yeah, there was a female wrestler who would go into old women's homes, basically befriend them, kill them, rob them, and then just go to the next one. She killed like over 10. But yeah, she was a legitimate wrestling... No one famous. She was always in like the lower rungs in Mexico. But she was a legitimate serial killer.
What I'm thinking is like truck drivers. Truck drivers, they had a few of those. That would pick these girls up and then go and kill them.
Mm.
But what if a wrestler, he'd be in a different state, different days, different this. I don't know how they would have tracked that down.
Oh, don't give Ryback any ideas, for God's sake.
Hey, Ryback, I didn't say that. Get it right.
Yeah, fair enough. We're going to move on. Mark Cole.
Hey, Bob Sweetan could have been a serial killer too. That's what made me think of it. Because serial killers have to be a little bit of whacked out.
Do you know? I wasn't going to mention this because I can't remember who it was meant to be exactly. It might have been his daughter. But do you know that Grizzly Smith has at one point been suspected of killing like his own daughter or something?
No, and not killing his own daughter.
Yeah, because he had...
Suspected. I don't think he was suspected. I think it was the daughter and Jake both brought it out that he had abused the daughter. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just going by what I heard they said. Grizz is a little bit out there too.
We'll bring up Grizzly. I need to research that more before I really bring it up, and we'll sort of mention it in a future episode. For now, we're going to move on. Mark Cole, Dutch and James on a recent podcast, you mentioned the Hells Angels, Don Fargo, and his unnamed partner, who I don't believe we couldn't remember his name. In the anecdote was Chris Colt. I believe Dutch was in Continental with him in 86 or 87 when he was doing the German Chris von Colt version of his character. As one of the wildest guys in the territory era, I wonder what kinds of stories Dutch has about him, either firsthand or from someone else. Thanks.
Don Colt?
Chris Colt.
Don Fargo.
No. Don Fargo, we were talking a couple of weeks ago, and we couldn't think who his tag team partner was in a certain situation. Anyway, it's Chris Colt, but stories about Chris Colt.
Well, I do know, and I don't know if this is Chris Colt, but I think Don Fargo was doing the biker gimmick. A bunch of bikers. Have I told this story?
This is what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and we couldn't think of who his tag team partner was.
Yeah, I think it was Don Colt. And they went to this biker get-together out in the woods someplace, and they had a fireplace burning, and they had some hot dogs on the grill, and they were all drinking. But the purpose of luring Don Fargo and Chris Colt out there was to beat the living shit out of them. And they barely got away before that. I guess they killed them. I mean, but they didn't get killed. But I think it messed Colt up pretty bad, and Don, I guess, was pretty fast afoot. So he got away. So just, and they were mad. This is what the bikers were mad about, because they were wearing their colors.
In fact, I think
after the regular person.
There you go.
Oh, that's sure. Don Fargo there.
No, that's Chris Colt. There we go. I'm going to show the camera now.
He, you know who he looks like? He looks like Rock Hunter. Fishco was never Rock Hunter, was he?
I don't think so. I don't know. Let me have a look. This is really not fascinating for the audio listeners, especially. So, but yeah, any other stories about Chris Colt?
No, I had heard that he was. I don't know. Can you still say this? He was gay.
Was he?
That's what I heard.
Okay.
But he's a bad kisser.
Mustache got in the way, I suspect.
Yeah. That is not funny. And if you laughed at that, that just shows you your state of mind.
Well, you
right
should
now.
Not say funny things then if you expect me not to laugh. Right, I'm going to maybe ask one or two more and then we'll shut it down. Nathan Walls. Why doesn't AEW book some smaller venues for its shows? While I look some of their TV shows, a lot of the times there are very few people in the upper deck. Why not move it to a smaller place and look more full? WWE doesn't need to do it as badly, but it seems like they would do that some too for a cheaper building rental. Sort of written a bit weird there. But AEW, should they book smaller venues? Might make them look a bit more small time, but it would fill the buildings.
Well, this is the same... line of thought that I displayed in TNA, which they probably didn't like too much, because we'd go to a building and it wouldn't be full. We'd be blocking off here and blocking off there. And that's why we did all our TVs in Orlando, because we could fill that place up. But I've seen that place in Orlando not filled up, and because tourists aren't going to go in there and sit for a 3-hour show. They want to go see other stuff. So they'd be in and they'd be out. But I told them, I said, I didn't tell them. I suggested when we go on the road, guys, book different smaller venues. We can fill that up. Don't book a 5,000 seat arena because we're not going to fill it up. And it actually looks bad when you don't fill that up. If you go to a smaller arena and you fill it up, then okay, now you're building. Now, you know, you got something behind you. But if, when you go to a 5,000 seat or a bigger building and you don't sell it out, you know, it makes the brand look bad. I think AEW, but I don't know, AEW might think they're going to sell those buildings out. How did they sell those Canadian? Did they sell them out?
No.
Those Canadian shots they just made?
No, the Canadian ones were pretty sparsely attended.
Well, it looks, but they did a good job of hiding it. They did a good job because you notice I remember I didn't see the upper decks. So that's what you got to go for when the camera does pan. If the upper deck's full, they're pretty well full.
I'll ask you one more.
But I did bring that up in TNA, and I think they need to bring that up in AEW. Of course, there's no way to tell once you book a building. There's no way to tell what it's going to do.
Well, they've got to book them up like, what, 6 months in advance or something as well? So,
at least.
Yeah.
Because they're taking, you know, when these tours go on the road, these bands, they book all that stuff in advance. So if you want to be there on a Wednesday night, I don't think it matters that much. Because you don't see a lot of big tours touring on Wednesdays and even Thursdays or Tuesdays. But on the Saturday night ones, they're going to have to book those probably about a year in advance, really.
I'll ask you one more question. We'll shut this down. Marvin asks, did you ever know a wrestler or wrestlers who loved to incite the crowd to riot? Comes back in the locker room and said, damn, that was a lot of fun. And he's the one wrestler who never even gets hurt in a riot. Also, the host has a great radio voice. I've also got a great face for radio as well, I believe. So, yes, riots. Who loved to cause a riot?
I don't think anybody loved to cause a riot, because then you got to get out of the riot. And I'm going to tell the story. Hmm? One time, it all goes back. One time.
It's already a good one, I can tell.
It was me and Bobby Eaton were in this match. And it was a Sunday afternoon, too. Now, who runs a Sunday afternoon wrestling show? Nobody except the company I was working for, and that was that Nick Gulas company that George Gulas, the greatest wrestler in the world, his daddy ran it. So we're in this town. I can't remember the name of it. But it was some ho-dunk town in Tennessee. And we dressed. We had to go in and down some stairs to the dressing room. So going down the stairs, it's like a high school gym. So when we went downstairs, now we were below ground level. And the windows opened right where the ground level was. You could see the grass outside the window. So I look up and there's a bunch of kids playing out there. Okay. So I'm watching those kids. All of a sudden, here comes a rock right through the window. I said, "Damn little bastards. Brother, I went out there." And Bobby went with me. He didn't want to, but he went anyway. And I saw these kids out there. And I said, "Did you throw that rock through the window?" "No, I didn't throw a rock at the window." "Well, why are you standing here?" "I don't know. I'm just standing here." I said, and all of a sudden now I didn't touch the kid or nothing. All of a sudden, it was a housing project. You know what a housing project is?
Mm-hmm.
It's government housing.
Mm. Densely populated. Sudden,
what?
Densely populated.
It is. All of a sudden, here comes some people out of those houses and apartments. "What are you doing, man? What are you doing? What are you doing?" And then I saw, now I'm outnumbered. And they're not saying nothing to the kid. They said something about me because the kid was about 14. So here they come out. And I said, "Well, I got to go. Got to back up." I did my de-escalation technique is running away.
Moonwalking backwards.
Yeah. So I went in there and all of a sudden, and it was a high school gym and the matches were going on. And all of a sudden we go back to the dressing room and all of a sudden there's some people, some cops at the top of the door holding people back. They were trying to get into the dressing room. And I said, "What the hell?" So then I didn't walk up there. Cops said, "No, you stay over there. And we'll keep them up here." I have never had people try. And I was a baby face. I was a good guy. So, you know, all the people sitting in there ready to watch a match with their hero, Dirty Dutch, all of a sudden people wanting to kill him. And I saw one guy kind of unholster his gun. I went, "Wait a minute." I told him, "Brother, don't even think about that. It's not going to be, please put it up." And he was nervous as hell. Hell, he made me nervous. But anyway, they got him away from the door. I went and had the match, but I had the match like this. I'm watching everywhere. So, and then we left and the guy said, "Dutch, where's your car?" He said, "I'll go get it for you." And I told him what it was. I gave him the keys. He drove it around to the front so I didn't have to go. And hell, they wasn't about 300 people there at the matches anyway. And so he drove it up, and there's a police car in front of us. And he says, "Well, here's your car, but we got to take you to court tonight." "Why?" He said, "They've taken out warrants on you and Bobby." "What?" I said, "I didn't do nothing." I said, "They broke. We'll go settle it out." So we went down to this police station and we're sitting in there. And here's me and Bobby. The show started about 3 o'clock in the afternoon or maybe four. It's 8 o'clock at night. And we're sitting at a table in the police station, blah, blah, blah. And we're waiting on the DA to come in, small town. And he come in, old Southern guy. He said, "Now, what the hell seems to be the reason here we all gathered here tonight?" And I told my story, and they told their story. Of course, they didn't tell anything about throwing the rock through the window. Of course, it may not have been them. I don't know. But I did go out there and blame them. I was probably more at fault than they were. But anyway, I remember that the DA said, "Well, due to conflict in evidence, I don't have any way to hold one party more liable than the other. So we're just going to dismiss this case, and y'all stay away from this type of behavior, okay? And we got up and left. They pissed off. They're all mad. I'm just glad I got out of there. And I got back. I left at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon to get to this stupid show. And I got back. I got back about 9 o'clock at night. No, 10 o'clock at night. I was gone almost 12 hours, 10 hours anyway, for nothing.
Were you technically arrested?
I wasn't technically arrested, but I was escorted to the police station in a police car. Me and Bobby Eaton. Now, they released Bobby Eaton right away because he got out of it.
So, I wasn't there. And that's pretty much it.
Bobby would say, oh, no, I don't know what happened. Having Bobby as a witness is like having a witness against you. Because they could take any of his answers and turn it around, and he'd get confused, and hell, he'd end up agreeing with the prosecution. Oh, my God.
Poor Bobby. Oh, we're going to end it on that. I mean, that's as good a story as any to end it on. Thank you very much for providing us for stories for all these people who've sent in the questions. If you want to have your question answered, please send it to questionsfordutch@gmail.com. But for now, we will catch you again Friday, 8 a.m. Eastern. That's when this podcast is released on YouTube and all podcast platforms. For now, Dutch, we the people.
With the right hand, this time, wait a minute. With the right hand, we the people.